Yeah, in designing the program, I remembered a rule I learned from previous conferences is always anchor the final morning with very strong speakers. And I think we have a really strong slate of speakers this morning, starting with our first speaker, Harry Atwater, who's the Otis Booth Leadership Chair of the Division of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Caltech. Harry's scientific interests center on photonic light matter interactions and solar energy conversion. Harry was an early pioneer of nanophotonics and in 2001 actually coined the term nanoplasmonics, if I'm pronouncing it right. His current work spans fundamental photonic phenomena and its applications, you know, spanning from very fundamental things to more applied topics like active metasurfaces, photonic structures, and 2D materials, and I think what we're going to hear about today, optical light sails. If I listed all the things Harry serves as a board member on or a fellow of, I would eat up a lot of his presentation time, but I will just mention in 2001, he was awarded the very prestigious Von Hippel Award from the MRS. So with that, I'll turn it over to Harry Atwater.
So I'm going to, this morning, give an overview of where the Starshot program, Breakthrough Starshot program, has advanced in the last few years from science to spacecraft and thinking about missions. And so I'm speaking on behalf of a group of collaborating leads here listed, Wes Green, Mike Helzenberg, Kevin Parkin, and Phil Moskoff. And of course, I think we're all, can you hear me? Okay. We're all drawn together by this question of whether life is common or rare, the Fermi paradox. And the exoplanet astronomers have basically brought us in the last two decades an incredible bounty of effectively, on average, one planet per star. And we have, you know, many stars in our stellar neighborhood within 10 light years. And indeed, shortly after the announcement of the Breakthrough Starshot Initiative, there was the report in 2016 of a habitable zone planet in our stellar backyard, so to speak, at Proxima B. And the question is, what is the opportunity or the consequence of going there as opposed to staying here and looking? And I think an interesting perspective on this comes from looking at the comparison of the images of Pluto that were generated by the Hubble Space Telescope versus those that were generated in the flyby at 700,000 kilometers from New Horizons. And, you know, the image quality there and the features that one sees and the things that one can infer are unmatched in this flyby. And I think that's an indication. So it's interesting to think about the question, suppose we had, we don't know what planet Proxima looks like, but suppose we had a Starshot light sail approaching the Earth. And we asked, what would the image be that we would see at a distance of a little under 3 AU, about 2 hours from the distance of closest approach at 20% of the light speed. And then suppose we're now looking at an hour later. So then we're going from less than 100 pixels in an image to about 100 pixels. And then finally, at the distance of closest approach at about a tenth of an AU, we see this. And this is the scale at which we can see, you know, this is the blue marble that we can see. We could see any technosignatures. We could infer a great deal about the atmosphere and the geographical strata and so forth that would be a spectacular eye-opening experience for humanity. And of course, as was reflected by the speakers yesterday, this is not a new idea. In fact, although Charles Townes invented the maser, the laser was actually invented by Ted Maimon at Hughes Research Lab in 1960. And indeed, shortly thereafter, Bob Forward, who was a colleague of Maimon's at Hughes, essentially, embraced the idea of the laser and saw the opportunity to consider a laser array illuminating a large Fresnel lens suspended in space, propelling a laser light sail. And so this, there were a few papers, this paper from Nature in the mid-60s that outlined some of the asymptotics for how close to the light speed one could go. And then finally, and there were a number of papers building in the interim, and then in 2015 and 2016, Phil Lubin essentially put together a very comprehensive paper called The Roadmap to Interstellar Flight, and it articulated a number of concepts, how you would build a phase array laser, many of the governing equations used to understand interstellar flight by laser-driven light sails, encoded and reported in a set of handy and convenient nomograms in this paper that you can use to essentially understand, get a sort of order of magnitude physics feel for how things work. So if we look at the key governing equations, mass as power to the array size or sail size divided by wavelength to the 1/2 power times mass to the -1/4, you can imagine that for if I'm pointing a laser pointer at the screen, I would be able to move something, a small object that weighs a gram like a tack, in the absence of gravity or friction or drag forces, to about a millimeter per second in a week's time. So that illustrates that the radiation pressure forces are weak. Photons are not particularly efficient for their momentum transfer, but their speed is spectacular. So that's the reason that we're drawn to light sails. So that immediately means that we need to think about high power, high power density. So a 50 gigawatt laser array with a power density at the light sail for the 20% light speed mission of 1 megawatt per centimeter squared. So that sounds like a spectacular amount of optical power. To an optical physicist, that sounds actually fairly modest. It's within the regime that's where materials respond. Most materials respond in a linear fashion. You know, you have to go to gigawatts per square centimeter before you start to encounter parametric nonlinearities in many dielectric materials. So if we think about this power density and power to accelerate to 20% of the light speed, a mass and payload of a gram, this requires then a sail of more than 10 square meters then an aperture on the ground to enable an impulse sufficient to facilitate this acceleration, such that we end up with a diffraction-limited laser spot size that is just filling or slightly overfilling the light sail at a distance of 2 million kilometers. And that requires an aperture of the order of hundreds of meters to a kilometer on the ground. And so that's sort of depicted here down the bottom. So buoyed by the enthusiasm for this possibility, Yuri Milner, who's financially supported the breakthrough initiatives and initiated the Breakthrough Starshot program in 2016 here at the World Trade Center, surrounded by this cast of characters. Many of the participants waxed philosophically at the time. Stephen Hawking said, "I believe what makes us unique is transcending our limits." Yuri Milner somewhat wisely observed, "If this mission comes to fruition, it will tell us as much about ourselves as about Alpha Centauri." Mae Jemison, astronaut, said, "We'll start," and the founder of the 100-year Starship effort, opined, we started space exploration thousands of years ago when we started to track the stars. And so this is sort of the next step. And Pete Worden said, "I just got to conclude this by saying this will be really cool, from hard challenges onto the sails, stars, Ad Astra." And so that launched a research program that was sponsored to identify fundamental science issues that would prevent or enable light sail design, design of light sail spacecraft, design of the photon engine to push the spacecraft, and the communication system to bring the signal back to Earth. And so this focused on the development of scientific principles. The question is do we defy any laws of physics? And if we don't, can we actually encode design concepts for the development of these key components? And of course, one of the real goals was to establish a worldwide scientific community, many people here are part of. And the group of participants in this initiative are listed below. It's quite a diverse group of more than 40 organizations. So let me say a little bit about some of the things that have been learned. So on the light sail, we have been able to identify light sail enabling materials. That's a good thing. We have a leading candidate and a number of alternatives in the parlance of the British monarchy, an heir and a spare. We have identified silicon nitride, the material that Richard Norte talked about, as a leading candidate. It's essentially a gift to us from the optomechanics community that has really refined and understood the absorption and reflection and mechanical properties of this material. And it certainly is capable of meeting the challenges, at least in principle. It's a very high strength, has high tensile strength and low absorption, potential for scale up to large sizes. There are other alternatives, other semiconductors and refractory materials, diamond and molybdenum disulfide and others that could also be effective light sail materials. We also developed optical designs for stable propulsion based on that enable beam riding and shape stability as well as thermal management to enable both the sail and its instrument payload to withstand reasonable temperatures. I'll show you a little bit about this. We developed simulation tools for understanding the sail dynamics. So just in terms of understanding materials, we developed sort of a material selection funnel that looked at materials, and the focus was really on refractory ceramic-like materials, wide band gap semiconductors. Many of these are familiar to solid state technologists, easy in many cases to deposit in thin film form, particularly with the advent of work on 2D materials. We developed selection criteria based on the mass density, the refractive index, which essentially is a good scaling parameter for the reflectivity and the ability to do optical engineering, and the absorption coefficient, which of course is critical to the thermal management, among other things. So that was described here. And then some of the simulation tools that were developed were multiphysics tools that allowed us to combine understanding of absorption, reflection, mechanical deformation, temperature, and so forth. So this shows an example of some of the simulations that looked at different light sail designs. Flat light sails are unstable. If you spin them, you can make them slightly more stable with regard to their shape, but they are not they don't exhibit beam riding stability. They essentially veer off the optical axis of the beam. So if you go to a parabolic sail, that enables, in principle, if you can maintain the shape, optical beam riding stability, but within the absence of rotation, we don't have shape stability. If we rotate, we have some shape stability. You can see here, this one is starts out shape stable and goes a little bit unstable by the end. By the way, this is all encoded with the tensile properties of silicon nitride with the tensile yield strength, so it's breaking at the time it should. On the other hand, if we were able to fabricate a parabolic light sail of many meters dimension and spin it at the appropriate angular velocity, we could see stable beam riding and shape-preserving stability. So one of the questions is, could we actually make flat light sails? Because those would be a lot easier to make than parabolas or some other shape like spheres. But flat light sails are unstable with respect to beam riding. But by encoding optical forces that produce restoring in-plane forces and torques by virtue of fabricating metagratings and metasurface structures, we can actually create phase profiles and angular dispersion of the light sail in flat form to achieve beam riding stability. And so with rotation, we can also achieve the shape stability. Essentially, thin light sails are always in what mechanics people would say is the membrane limit of mechanics, not the beam bending. So these membranes have zero stiffness, so we have to achieve stiffness in other ways. So we've also looked at, in the laboratory, building test stations that enable us to characterize the optical forces and the radiation pressure forces using small facsimiles of these metagrating light sails here. This is an experimental sample shown here. It's essentially an optomechanics experiment, but it's meant to to characterize the properties of light sails under the conditions, megawatt per square centimeter beam power densities, which we have to go. The reason we're using light small samples is because we're interested in going to the power densities that are characteristic of the interstellar mission, even though we can't achieve the size at the moment. So we were able to do that and characterize the forces and torques and analyze stability. So the other thing we've been able to do is get some ideas around the photon engine. So this is a depiction of what the photon engine might look like, notionally sitting in a clear-seeing desert location. Imagining that you would have to build this over a timescale of 10 years, this gives you an idea of the, if you think about the size, it's essentially an array of identical optical elements where the phase distribution is precisely controlled to all the components. And this gives you an idea of the number of components you have to fabricate depending on their size. And so it gives you some idea of the mass manufacturing challenge required. So another advance was understanding the characteristics of the orbiting beacon required for feedback and phase control. This is essentially the inverse of the problem for adaptive optics for telescopes that use a guide star. And so the characteristics of the guide star for the Starshot mission were identified, and essentially the orbit has to track the night sky to about one arc second and away from the spacecraft itself. So another important conceptual advance was a development, this is a group at Australian National University that developed a hierarchical architecture for the phase control of hundreds of millions of lasers. So they didn't demonstrate this experimentally, but they did small breadboard experiments on, you know, a few to a dozen laser samples, but importantly showed how you could distribute, first to 100, then to 1,000, and each of those 1,000 feeding another 1,000. So you can see how you would get at least an architecture for driving of the order of 100 million separate laser emitters with a phase control. Very important to the whole enterprise is the cost. The cost of such a mission is dominated by the cost of the photon engine, and the cost of the photon engine is related to, but not entirely limited by, the cost of the components themselves. And this gives you an idea of the scaling, the sort of Moore's law-like scaling that has historically occurred for semiconductor and fiber amplifier lasers, and just caution, some projections here for where these technologies could go. And so if you think about a time at which you would build a large-scale photon engine being somewhere in the 2040 to 2050 range, then this would guide you to the idea that we may be able to do this for somewhere between a penny to 10 cents a watt. So the communications team is focused on the question of how one develops the transmitter from the spacecraft and the receiver on Earth based on laser communications to send data back. A key question was, how do you define the figures of merit for this seemingly almost impossible problem? There is an existing example of laser communications that's about to fly its first demo this year, which will be the Deep Space Optical Communications demo on the Psyche mission. The goal is to return a 100 kilobit image like the ones I showed you earlier. And so assuming you can do the following things that I will tell you about, there does not appear to be a barrier to achieving the required data rates and total data. And what's required to span the sort of orders of magnitude gap between the signal-to-noise reception of the current deep space optical communication, so basically the delivered and received power ratio, is about six orders of magnitude. So where are we going to get those six orders of magnitude? One of the key places will be to deploy a large array of ground stations, optical receivers on the ground based on low-cost telescope designs. And the with, I'll show you an example of what we think could be a design for the onboard transmitter, laser transmitter. And then thinking about advances in signal encoding and detection using superconducting single photon detectors allows us another one or two orders. So a key technology that's instrumental for both the imaging and signal distribution using optical communications is an emerging technology in the world of solid state devices called optical phased arrays and active metasurfaces. So phased arrays have been around for a long time, and RF phased arrays are used commonly in communications and power beaming. The same sort of technology is now coming to optics in integrated form, and some examples are shown here. Chip-based optical phased arrays and a related concept called active metasurfaces, where the beam actually scatters from the surface from the far field and then is reflected or transmitted, but steered nonetheless, are under a period of rapid development right now. And we foresee this was going to lead to the possibility of making very lightweight lensless cameras and lensless receivers and transceivers. So here's a concept that was developed at the University of Arizona for a relatively low-cost optical telescope. So using low-cost designs similar to those that are used in solar concentrating heliostats, the same kind of materials. And then showing Galvo piezo structure that allows for control of correction using mechanical instabilities in these low-cost telescope designs. So now let me say a little bit about some of the things that putting these things together, a vision for the spacecraft, for the photon engine, and for the optical communications receiver. First, the spacecraft. So here's a vision for what the spacecraft could look like. Is there a laser pointer here? Is there a... Oh, I can just do that. Yeah, okay. Okay. Let's see, right there. Yeah. And then that one. There you go. Okay. Okay, so the light sail itself is for the interstellar mission. Here's the 0.2C mission is depicted here. As 4 meters in diameter. The communications aperture here, I'll describe how this works in a minute, is about 1 meter in size. And we've also, for in this conceptual design, added elements here for the image sensors. These are redundantly distributed lensless image sensors. These are thin film versions of radioisotope thermoelectric generators for power generation. Computing and electronics, not shown in detail, magnetometry, and then also light sources, LED light sources for spacecraft attitude control. So this is a sort of a concrete, and then another key component here is a laser reflector layer that is positioned between the instruments that are located on this light sail and the light sail itself, which is formed of the silicon nitride metagrating. And those laser reflectors are there to manage the temperature during the photon engine acceleration phase so that they survive the launch and are available to do the science mission. So how are we going to design lensless transmitters and imaging apertures? That's using phased arrays with electro-optic materials in thin film form like lithium niobate. This is just a sort of artist's impression of things that are being prototyped in the lab now that include resonant antenna elements where the electro-optic elements adjust the relative phase at optical frequencies among these different elements. I should say that at this point, there are working devices. Our lab has produced some of these for beam steering and electronic focusing of beams in one dimension. We've been able to achieve very high numerical aperture lenses with electronic focusing in the 1000 to 1550 nanometer range. Two-dimensional devices are still a challenge, mainly because of the interconnect distribution, and that seems like a soluble challenge, but not one that academics have taken on yet. So the laser reflector consists of a photonic crystal device. It's a hybrid of silicon nitride with molybdenum disulfide and has the properties that it is highly reflecting at the pump laser wavelength to minimize the total absorption to begin with, and also has high infrared thermal emissivity at the blackbody temperature peak wavelength for the light sail when it gets hot. So that's the design of the layer that's there to prevent overheating of the instruments. So the metagratings are fabricated directly in silicon nitride. I showed you experimental samples of those, and that's something that can be extended out over using large-scale printing techniques. One of our collaborators, Meta, not the Facebook Meta, but another Meta Materials Meta, has produced printing methods for printing these at the meter scale. So this is a schematic of something that's been experimentally realized, which is a thin film version of our radioisotope thermoelectric generator, where the heat radioisotope heat source is placed in the center of this annular structure, and the individual ligaments here are thermoelectric materials that are connected in series to generate power. And so a power working group did an analysis of what were the power requirements, and the light sail needs about 14 kilojoules with a 20 microwatt trickle power during the mission and up to 1 watt peak power during times that we transmit signals using the optical aperture on the light sail. So this seems among, the power working group considered a number of alternatives, thin film batteries, fuel cells, alpha and beta photovoltaics, photovoltaics or stellar voltaics, if you like, conclude this was probably the one that seemed most practical to begin with, but a number of other ideas are in play. So let me say a little bit about the photon engine. The photon engine uses a guide star, and this is just a cartoon showing the version of the guide star showing the beacon in the sky here and about an arcsecond away from the light sail, which is now being steered by the photon engine on its trajectory towards Alpha Centauri. And so this basically consists of elements that feed back the optical phase fluctuations that across the optical aperture due to the atmospheric refractive index instabilities to the low power portion that enables the phase control of each element of the laser array. Each of the laser elements is a semiconductor element. This shows a cross-section of the semiconductor structure. It's a compact semiconductor material that creates a vertical cavity external surface emitting laser. It's a solid state laser based in 3-5 semiconductors. The external cavity is defined by here a diffractive primary lens and mirror, laser cavity mirror, and the lens is designed so that the beam fills this optical element. The active semiconductor element here is a fraction of a millimeter in size, and each optical element here we imagine is of the order of half a centimeter in size. So if we think about assembling these elements can get assembled into tiles, each tile, an assembly of 10 square centimeter elements. So each tile corresponds to a power output of about 280 watts. And then the photon engine panel, an array of tiles here, which is a couple of meters in size, has an output here of a little more than 100 kilowatts. The vertical cavity external surface emitting lasers, the tiles, the panels, and so forth are then arrayed, of course, into an array at the kilometer scale to give the rise to the full 200 gigawatt scale element. So this gives you the number of tiles, about 700 million tiles. So that's a large number of tiles, but that gives you an idea of the scale of the structure. So let me say a little bit about the communication receiver. So the goals are to demonstrate a scalable receiver that has the mass and cost requirements to produce the large area aperture. And by the way, it doesn't need to be a phased array. It can be incoherent because these are just light buckets collecting photons. We just need to have more buckets to collect photons. So each receiver has this form. It has a primary mirror, Cassegrain design, where the reflected light feeds into a receiver coupled to an optical fiber array, and the fibers are then distributed to a detector. So here, this shows what an entire bank of these low-cost detectors might look like, you know, the order of 22 detectors in a bank at the, you know, few meter scale. Here's how you might lay them out here as a block subsection. It's about the size of a soccer field, corresponding to 1,024 tiles of this receiver. And the number of tiles in an array here, let's imagine, by the way, there's no requirement that you, because it's not a phased array and these are just light buckets, you could position them anywhere you like, but suppose you put them into an array like this. This gives you an idea of the size here of a 32 by 32 tile array, and the full receiver would require something like 50 blocks of this size. So the optical fibers feed into a fiber bundle coupled to an imager with a dispersing element that disperses photons onto a single photon detector array. So these are all components that exist today. The scale is substantial, shall we say, but these are all things that you can envision and develop sort of concrete images of today. So let me say a little bit about some of the missions that we envision. One is the possibility of building a spacecraft that could achieve, prior to the interstellar mission, 100 AU per year velocity. So what would that enable? That would be faster than the speed of the closest diving Sundiver missions that we currently envision that would use solar radiation pressure. That would enable us to consider exploring the interstellar medium, looking at Kuiper Belt objects in the outer solar system, going to the solar gravity lens point, and with a sail that would be about the same size as the light sail I depicted for the interstellar. The payload mass would be a little larger, of the order of a few grams. The impulse for the photon engine would last longer, not tens of minutes, but maybe a couple of hours. And this is all just to sort of falls out of the kind of nomograms that you can use to define the acceleration. So, going to the interstellar is really a mission, is really a question to achieve the mission of reducing the cost of the photon engine to the point where you can build a photon engine that allows you to go to progressively larger and larger fractions of the light speed. And this is sort of an envisioned pathway for how you might do this with a goal of achieving being ready to build in 2050, build and commission the full interstellar mission for Starshot, operating at the 0.2C point design mission. So that would enable us to, and that is a set of ideas that now gives us a concrete idea, a concrete set of sort of things we can discuss about how to design the light sail and its mission. Thanks.
Have any questions for Perry?
Well, congratulations for the whole project. Of course, it's very innovative. Now, let me just convey to you, please, an idea that I had much earlier than Starshot became a reality. And this is about telecommunications. I had been working on a trans, mathematically, on a transform better than a Fourier transform. It's called KLT, Karun-Lorentz transform, or principal axis transformation in the Hilbert space, spanned by the eigenfunction of the autocorrelation of the signal, right? Now, I had published that for mathematical delight much before Starshot, and if you agree, I would send you the papers, and then you please tell me whether this may be or not, may not be useful for your project. Thank you.
This is amazing work. I have very little to offer technically, so I'm going to ask a question that I know even less about, which is the economics. So
okay.
This idea that right now we're at about $1 a watt, and that when we get to a penny a watt or a tenth of a penny a watt, that would be the enabling point for these gigawatt
the laser system.
Architecture. So I challenged a couple of years ago a group of ECE students for their capstone project to build me a 1 watt laser amplifier just so I could come up the learning curve a bit. And we couldn't get the cost below about $5,000 to build that little 1 watt amplifier. And one of the main manufacturers of the ytterbium doped fiber is actually here in Quebec, is Coractive. And when I called them, I said, you know, all my colleagues keep telling me you can make these, you know, gain fibers for $1 a watt. And they said, well, that's what it costs us to make one extra meter of gain fiber, but we're not going to sell it to you for that price. And then I asked about rejects and so on. And so I guess, I just want to make sure I understand the economics of this. Would the idea be that you would probably need to build your own foundry? You need to build your own to actually gain that economic?
Well, so the idea of learning curves is that there is an overall market that's driving down the cost of the components. And there are, you know, other markets that are driving laser components. I should say that the fiber laser is the what we see as the maybe the near-term, more feasible near-term design or architecture. But the one that seems most attractive from the cost viewpoint is the solid-state semiconductor laser. And there are, you know, you can certainly purchase pump diode lasers. Not with all the phase control and so forth that you need, but pump diode lasers for, you know, much lower cost than that.
And you can get the beam quality that's needed? Because I thought the fiber was the next step after this.
Well, so in order to achieve the beam quality, you need to build that component, that little pixel of element, which contains the cavity, the amplifier, and all those elements. So I should say that there is a cost model that was performed, what we have it is in report form, and the authors I think are prepared. This is a group at Australian National University that also did the phase control architecture, and so they've done an analysis of this of the cost, and it's not published yet, but I expect that it will be in due course, and we'll have a chance to have a look at it. Yeah.
Okay.
But it is one of the key issues.
For people that are just joining in, we pushed the schedule back a few minutes because we were a little shaky starting this morning after last night. So we're just going to shift the program by about 10 minutes.
That's amazing. I have two sorts of questions. One is, what do you plan for that 10-gram payload? And the other, is there any possibility of doing atmospheric science in Venus, or having it land on Mars or Europa or any of these astrobiology targets?
Okay, so I guess the question of landing, so that requires deceleration. And so we haven't really thought about landing. You might think about atmospheric, sort of skimming atmospheres and doing atmospheric sampling. And so we've thought about missions where you would do maybe chemical characterization of the atmosphere. In terms of payloads, a payload budget of a few grams is still pretty demanding. So we're thinking primarily in terms of things like image sensors and magnetometers. But certainly one of the things we want to do is to understand people's wish list for instruments. And there are many opportunities to build instruments now. And some of the technologies I described are going to give, I think, impetus to building microinstruments in a real revolutionary fashion over the next decade.
Thank you.